Tom Daschle is shovel-ready to fix American healthcare.
Well, I describe our healthcare system this way. We have islands of excellence in a sea of mediocrity.
And he's jumping right into that sea. Daschle's on his way to heading up the Department of Health and Human Services. He's just one of the Obama policy team getting to know the cabinet before they start work. We're shovel-ready right here at The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, January 8th, 2009, and Daschle faces nomination hearings today on Capitol Hill. So
that's
we'll
right.
have a report about that, a preview. Also today, Congress counts the votes that will officially put President-elect Obama in the White House, and pressure for a Gaza ceasefire. It's growing. Those stories coming up. First, these headlines.
A new player is stepping into the Middle East conflict this morning. Lebanese militants have launched several rockets into Israel's north. Israeli forces returned fire, but military spokeswoman Major Avital Leibovich says Israel isn't looking to move beyond the fight in Gaza.
A few rockets were launched at Israeli towns in the northern part of Israel. We retaliated to the fire. This is an isolated event, and by no means it has any relevance to opening a second front.
The Israeli military says it will again stop the assault on Gaza for a few hours today to let humanitarian aid in. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice wants to see more.
I'm pleased that the Israelis were able to open a humanitarian corridor and to provide a pause for humanitarian action, but that needs to be repeated again and again.
The halt in operations is set to last 3 hours.
Things are heating up on the diplomatic front. Israeli officials are in Egypt today for talks on a French-Egyptian ceasefire proposal. Cairo says Hamas and the Palestinian Authority officials from those two organizations will be there for separate discussions. Palestinian Authority spokesman Rafiq Husseini says Israel should make a deal.
All they're undermining is the two-state solution, which serves Israel more than it even serves the Palestinians. What we are trying to do, what the PA is trying to do, is to get the land to establish the Palestinian state on with peaceful means.
The U.S. has says it supports the French-Egyptian ceasefire plan. President-elect Barack Obama has mostly been silent about Gaza, but today he'll have a lot to say about his economic plan. The president-elect unveils his stimulus package in a major speech about 3 hours from now. The mix of tax cuts, new programs, and aids to states could cost up to $800 billion. Before that speech, we'll get a fresh look at the jobless situation. In about a half an hour, a key report on the latest weekly unemployment claim comes out. And tomorrow, we'll get a broader report on the job market.
Unemployment for December, that's tomorrow. Europe wants an end to its national gas problem, which is also a Russia-Ukraine problem. Russian and Ukrainian energy leaders are in Brussels today. The EU wants them to make a deal so the gas will flow into cold, wintry Europe. The Dow closed at 87.69 yesterday. The S&P begins trading at 9.06. Healthcare is the issue. Tom Daschle, as we said, is shovel-ready to head Health and Human Services. We're looking for stories from your life. What do you think is job one for American healthcare? Join the A-team and figure out what to do for healthcare as Tom Daschle begins his confirmation hearings. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. This week, there's been much talk about how the newly sworn-in Congress is striving for a spirit of bipartisanship and cooperation in this new year. But there are signs that the veneer is already cracking.
It is kind of in between your eyes, Mr. Cheney. After all you did, after all you said to Democrats and to Mr. Obama, look what is happening here today. You have to preside over the final part of this election that will seat him.
That was California Congresswoman Maxine Waters talking about Vice President Dick Cheney, who today will formally sign off on the electoral vote count, officially making Barack Obama the president-elect. Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection joins us from Washington. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning.
Is that a more frustration at the Bush administration from Representative Waters, or is that a sign of what's to come between Democrats and Republicans as they move forward this year?
It sounds to me like a little bit of gloating, really. Maxine Waters has a long history in the Congress and a long history with Republicans, so she's probably gloating a little bit. But it's certainly not in keeping with the spirit of bipartisan cooperation and friendliness that a lot of people have been making an effort to display in this, you know, in the first week of the 111th Congress. Now, what she was talking about, of course, was the official counting of the electoral votes in a joint session of Congress. Barack Obama, by the way, is not the president-elect, not yet, not until this afternoon after those votes are certified. So I think Waters is probably letting out some of her frustrations and, yeah, a little bit of gloating.
And so that's coming from the House. And then in the Senate, you have Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who's scheduled to vote for this weekend, which he knows senators loathe to vote on the weekend, certainly not handing out an olive branch.
The first vote of the new Congress for the Senate, and it's going to be on a Sunday. You're exactly right. This is an old fight between Reid, the majority leader, and Senator Tom Coburn, the conservative budget hawk from Oklahoma. It's an old bill from last year, a package of 140 or so smaller bills all wrapped up together on a public lands bill, national parks, federal land and how they're used, different programs for them. Coburn thinks it's a waste of money, and that's fine. But Reid, as they get into these procedural fights, as often happens in the Senate, it's completely normal, Reid has said, fine, Coburn, you want to have your delays? We're going to vote on Sunday. And senators, when you're all on the floor Sunday voting and you're not with your families, you'll know who to thank. It's Tom Coburn. So there's already this – it seems a lot like the old Congress in this new cooperative Congress. This first week, they're getting off on a little bit of a bad foot, I think.
Is there anything Coburn can do this time around to thwart this vote on Sunday?
Well, he's already doing it. That's why they're voting on Sunday, because Reid is getting his vote in there, his procedural vote, at the earliest possible time. It'd be very easy just to get unanimous consent and let it wait until Monday. That's
Todd,
easy to do, but they're not doing it.
Todd, this is a sort of sketch of what could be a fairly protracted conflict between the Democratic leadership in the Senate and Republicans. But are there any policy implications other than missing football games on Sunday?
Not on this one. There aren't a whole lot, unless you live next to a national park or you're a planner for federal lands. It's a relatively obscure bill, to be honest. This is sort of this is one of these internecine fights that happened in the Senate. And this is an old battle, and I think you're seeing some frustrations bleed over from last year.
But I guess what I'm asking is, if this continues, is it going to have an effect on judicial appointments and all the sort of dramas that we're so tired of in Washington?
If it continues, John, there's no question that it will have that effect. However, this question was put to the minority leader, Mitch McConnell, who's Coburn's leader, yesterday, saying, hey, I thought the acrimony was supposed to be gone for at least the first little bit here. Why are you guys reverting to the old ways? And he didn't take up Coburn's fight at all. He said, look, Coburn has the right to object. Don't read anything into it. This isn't a new acrimonious spirit. This is just Reid and Coburn going at it. So he's not latching on to this and joining the fight. So I think at least the leadership is trying to avoid this bleeding over into the bigger job that has to be done.
Let's talk about another element there on Capitol Hill, something of a shifting of the winds, I think, when it comes to Roland Burris, the Senate appointee from Illinois, who was appointed by the embattled Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. Harry Reid, several weeks ago, said, no way are we going to seat anyone appointed by that governor. But now it seems as if Roland Burris may be on his way after a meeting with Harry Reid yesterday to being ultimately seated.
That's right. Well, Harry Reid does have a history of saying no way, not going to happen, no way, and then somehow it happens about a week later. So this might be one of those examples, but it seems like the Democratic leadership was running out of reasons to keep Burris out of the Senate. Now, they haven't said he'll be seated. They've given him a path to be seated, but there still are ways to fall off that path. As you know, he has to go back to Illinois today and testify and do all those things and come back with a certification. However, when he does come back, it's probably going to go to the Rules Committee, and very very quickly, there's a wrinkle here. The leader of the Rules Committee right now is Dianne Feinstein. She has said Burris should probably be seated. However, the Senate hasn't reorganized its committees yet. They're in the process of doing that. If the Burris nomination goes to Rules while Feinstein is
right.
still in charge, likely to go quickly. However, the new chairman, Chuck Schumer, a member of the leadership and a Reid ally.
That could be an entirely different story, but certainly looks like he could be on his way. And, of course, we will turn to you for the updates on that story. Todd Zwillick, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Todd Zwillick, a reporter for Capital News Connection, reporting from Washington.
Oh, no. For all you need to know, go, go, Todd Zwillick.
And as Go-Go Todd Zwillick said, score one for Roland Burris on his first road trip to Washington. Looks like he's doing pretty well in Washington, but he's back home for a contest in the home stadium there in Springfield, Illinois. And joining us for a further discussion of the Roland Burris drama is Amanda Vinicky, our pal from Springfield, Illinois, State House reporter for Illinois Public Radio, WUIS. Amanda, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So Burris is back to testify in the impeachment drama that's going on in the legislature. What is Burris's play here? Is it to defend himself or to take down Blagojevich, to help the Illinois legislature take down Blagojevich?
You know, I think at this point he's probably worried about himself. And I think he does have some questions to answer. You have Republicans who called him to come before this committee in the first place. And they say that they want to hear from him about the at least $20,000 in campaign contributions that he's given to Blagojevich over the years. And that doesn't count what is not yet public, because filings haven't had to be made in terms of what contributions he's made in the past 6 months or so. They want to hear about connections between Burris's law firm and consulting firm and lobbying firm in Patty Blagojevich, the governor's wife. And there is a connection there with Burris's partner for this firm and him. Perhaps there are questions if he helped Patty Blagojevich get a job as a not-for-profit development director. There's all sorts of questions swirling around here in terms of, everybody says Roland Burris is a great guy, great public servant, but you do have Republicans raising some questions saying, wait a second, could there be a quid pro quo? We're talking about a governor who tried to sell a seat. How can we be guaranteed that that did not happen in this case with Roland Burris?
Well, if it gets really murky, will keep the Illinois legislature away from the main event, and that is getting around to dealing with Rod Blagojevich himself. And here, Republican Representative Susan Bassey is expressing some significant impatience that, you know, they're not moving faster on that. Listen.
He's been already cut off by the Homeland Security people. He's cost us 20-some million dollars because of his trials and tribulations. You guys, we're beating a dead horse here. For goodness sakes, let's get moving on this.
What does Representative Bassey want to get moving on?
You know, she wants to get moving on impeachment. I think that a lot of the lawmakers are hearing pressure from the public and saying, we need to get this guy out of here. And also you have legislators saying the longer that Rod Blagojevich is in office and maintains the power as governor to do things in terms of signing laws, appointing senators, budgeting, what have you, that the worse it is for the state. They say we need to get this embattled governor out of here and stop playing games. That, again, Representative Bassey is a Republican, and it was Republicans who called Burris and are kind of delaying it. The other delay, I guess, is that the impeachment panel is waiting to hear today as well from a judge if they will be allowed to have released to them some of the recorded phone conversations on which Governor Blagojevich is supposedly scheming for bribes
right.
and such.
And that
so
sort of
we're
is
waiting
the
to hear if
that's
that'll be allowed.
That's the conflict with the federal investigation. All right, quickly, let's go back to scenarios. If Burris survives his interaction with the Springfield legislature on the question of his relationship with the governor, and the governor is impeached, does Burris get reappointed by the lieutenant governor, or do they find another candidate? How's this going to work really quickly?
It's all up in the air, and nobody really knows at
this
point.
Oh, darn it. Oh, man.
But I don't think so. I think the governor is governor right now. He has the legal rights. Right now, it's up to the Illinois Supreme Court to decide if the Secretary of State, Jesse White, has to sign this document to get Burris seated by the U.S. Senate.
Well, maybe score one for Burris in Springfield as well. Amanda Vinicky, State House reporter for Illinois Public Radio, WUIS. Thanks so much, Amanda.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Today there's going to be lots of questions about health care on Capitol Hill as former Senator Tom Daschle is asked questions as he tries to become the head of the Health and Human Services in the Obama administration. So we're looking for stories from your life. What have you seen? What have you experienced? What do you think needs first aid in America's healthcare system?
Remember how everybody was happy that Teddy Kennedy was flying to be able to use the best doctors for his condition? Well, if he has the best doctors, somebody else has the worst doctors. How do you keep him from monopolizing the best doctors?
Thank you for that thought. We'd like to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
We turn now to the military confrontation between Israel and Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And the situation there is really changing hour by hour. So we are joined live by Jim Muir, BBC Middle East correspondent, who's in Beirut, where the question this morning is, with some evidence of rockets crossing the border into northern Israel, is Hezbollah and the situation in Lebanon a sign of restraint or a sign that things are about to blow in the north? Jim Muir?
I would say that so far the signs are actually quite reassuring. There was an incident in the early morning local time here when probably three rockets were fired across the border from just inside Lebanon. And of course, this immediately raised fears. It caused some degree of panic in northern Israel because, of course, it raised memories of the 2006 war when thousands of Hezbollah rockets were fired across the border. So people thought this might be the precursor. But it turns out that they were certainly or almost certainly fired by some unknown group, possibly the PFLP-GC, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, which is headed by Ahmed Jibril, who had threatened to open up other fronts against Israel if the Gaza fighting went on. Now, that's a small Palestinian group. It's got nothing much to do with Hezbollah. Hezbollah has made it clear that it did not fire those rockets and has no interest in stirring up trouble on the northern border. The Lebanese government has reiterated its commitment to Resolution 1701 and to keeping things quiet. The Lebanese army is trying to find out who did fire those rockets. Now, Israel did fire back, but in a very limited way. It fired probably half a dozen mortar rounds across into that very area where the rockets had come from. It did not escalate the situation. It was a very pinpoint response, very restrained. And so far, the signs are that both sides, both Hezbollah and Israel, are not spoiling for a fight on the Lebanese border.
Although the rhetoric seems to be bellicose, at least on the Hezbollah side, and with all of the Israeli analysts and many people around the world talking about echoes of 2006, where Hezbollah, of course, had a favorable outcome in a brutal war in Lebanon with Israel, describe on the one hand, the bellicose rhetoric on the part of Hezbollah and what appears to be a fairly responsible and delicate dance of restraint on both sides.
That's right. There is a level of shall we say, posturing on both sides, actually. I mean, Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, has made a lot of statements saying, we are ready for you. If you attack us, we will give you a worse time than we gave you in 2006, and so on. But he has not given any hint that they would initiate things, that they're looking for a fight. They're saying, if a fight is imposed on us, we will defend ourselves and we will give a good account. On the Israeli side, likewise, they've said, if Hezbollah does something, we are ready, and we're ready for all possibilities. So both sides are saying, we can do it, but the signs are that neither wants to.
Now, there are talks going on in Israel separately between Hamas, Fatah, Palestinian authority leaders, and Hamas leaders, and the diplomacy is certainly on the table at this point. It seems to me 13 days into this conflict, though, Jim, that the real story is this sense of restraint. Let's focus on the West Bank for a moment. You would have thought in the past that a prolonged conflict like this with the kinds of pictures that are coming out would have provoked a new intifada or a new sort of sense of more or less unbridled unrest in the occupied territories. Why has the West Bank been so quiet?
Well, funnily enough, I was just talking last night to somebody who'd come from the West Bank and been kind of researching that very question. At the beginning, don't forget, Hamas basically fought Fatah, the other big Palestinian organization which dominates the Palestinian Authority, certainly in the West Bank. They fought them in Gaza and they threw them out, and it was very bloody and very internecine. So when this thing started up, a lot of people in the West Bank who are Fatah sympathizers basically quietly thought to themselves, great, you know, the guys who gave us a bad time are having a bad time too. As it has gone on, their feelings have changed. It's not so one of this is a thing against Hamas, it is this is a thing against the Palestinians and everybody is suffering. So there is a quite strong feeling growing, but you haven't seen this kind of really out of control raging anger for, I think, those reasons. They had very mixed feelings at the beginning, and it's taken time for their kind of Palestinian nationalistic feelings, if you like, or their feelings of solidarity with the ordinary people who are being hurt and killed and having their lives turned upside down in Gaza, for those feelings to come to the fore.
So aside from what Arab leaders are saying about this raising the profile of Hamas, I mean, if this quiets down quickly, it does appear as though one of the consequences is going to be a reveal of the isolation of Hamas in the Palestinian national movement, not a raising of its profile.
I think it's really too early to say. It depends really on the exact balance of power as reflected in any truce or ceasefire that comes out. In a general way, Hamas, I think, has been politically boosted by this because that's what happens. People rally round when they come under attack from outside. So in a general way, that's the case. But if they are obliged to accept conditions that imply that they've kind of lost or that they've been weakened in some way, then they will come out of it badly. On the other hand, as I say, if they come out of it with a solid agreement to open up Gaza, to open up the crossings that would stabilize the situation and lead to a better life for people, they may be given credit for that. So I think we'll have to look very carefully at the formula that comes out of all this diplomacy to kind of gauge how it's going to rebound on the various players, including Hamas.
Well, a delicate moment both diplomatically and militarily, and the Arab world is very much watching to see what happens next. From Beirut, Jim Muir joins us there from the BBC. He's the Middle East correspondent based in Beirut. Thank you, Jim. And now Femi Okeh has some headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Russia and Ukraine state gas companies had a surprise meeting in Moscow about their energy dispute. It's the first meeting since Russia cut off gas shipments to Ukraine in a billing dispute. And with frigid temperatures across Europe, the European Commission President José Manuel Barroso is eager for the dispute to be resolved.
We really hope that the Russians put the gas in the network, the Ukrainian network, and that the Ukrainians do not interrupt the gas from Russia to come to the European Union.
The cutoff has left many European countries with vastly reduced natural gas supplies. Congress will begin the ceremonial task of counting the Electoral College votes from November's election. Vice President Dick Cheney and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi preside over the session that will formally declare Barack Obama the winner. Protests in Oakland, California turned violent last night. Demonstrators set cars on fire and broke windows, protesting at a New Year's Day shooting of an unarmed man by a police officer. Let's look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, folks. Count them. There are 19 members of President-elect Obama's cabinet headed for Senate confirmation over the next 2 weeks. These are the men and women who will execute the president's vision. They are his 21st century team of rivals, team of friends, allies, and the policy people who will be making that vision come true. And it's time to meet them in a deep way. And that's what we're going to be doing over the next 2 weeks on The Takeaway. We'll be following these personalities and concerns about them on the program and online, meeting them face to face, if we can, on thetakeaway.org.
Today, the first one up who will be facing a confirmation hearing on Capitol Hill is former Senator Tom Daschle, who's up for Secretary of Health and Human Services. Many expect Daschle, a former Senate Majority Leader, to get confirmed. So what's the job he's inheriting, and how will he approach it? Len Nichols has some thoughts on that. He's the director of the Health Policy Program at the New America Foundation, and he joins us from Arlington, Virginia. Good morning, Len.
Good morning, Adora.
So what is this new role? Not only is he up for Secretary of Health and Human Services, but also something that President-elect Barack Obama is calling the director of the new White House Office on Health Reform.
Well, it's proof that Senator Daschle is the right fellow for this job, because not only was he a former senator and therefore he understands the Senate and he understands the cabinet relationship to the Senate from the secretary's position, but he understands that being in the White House simultaneously is essential to making it clear to the world he speaks with one voice, that he is the appropriate administration spokesperson on health care. And that's a big lesson from 1993-94, when they had too many cooks in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. And Len, clearly the senator has many, many thoughts on health care. He wrote a book this year called Critical, What We Can Do About the Health Care Crisis, and some called his ideas radical, others call them reform-minded. I mean, he's talking about creating a federal health board that's essentially modeled after the Federal Reserve System.
Well, that's right, and I think it's interesting he used the word radical and reform in the same sentence. Indeed, he calls his book critical. The truth is, we can't fix our health care system unless we take some very big steps. We need to move a couple of business models off the horizon and improve upon them. And to do that, to make those kinds of big changes, you're going to have to move some big pieces around. But I think it's fair to say his book reflects a lot of received wisdom. It's actually not that radical in the reform community, because he does have all the big pieces. And most importantly, he's clearly learned three of the big lessons from 94. And they are, you've got to be humble. You're not going to write the perfect bill in an administration alcove and deliver it like a sculpture unveiling before the public square. You've got to make sure you've got some bipartisan support. And you got to let others take credit. And that's part of why Senator Daschle is the right guy. He knows how to work the Senate. He knows how to work the Congress. He knows how to work different kinds of thoughts together into a whole that can make a successful package last.
And Len, at the center of his thought seems to be this idea that you build on what we already have, the healthcare system we already have in this country, and create a public-private hybrid.
Well, that's right, and that's in many ways, that's the simplest way to go from where we are to where we need to be, because that is what we have now. What he's really talking about is just like President-elect Obama, and for that matter, a lot of the other candidates in the campaign. Indeed, even many Republican ideas are very much in this mix. You want to make a marketplace that works for everyone. You want to have information play a much bigger role than it does now. You want to have incentives to be improved. You've got to do all that. The idea behind the board is really, in some sense, a metaphor for getting some of the micromanagement decisions out of Congress and into the hands of people and the people who understand the system better.
Well, Len, I'm heartened to see and hear how many of the policy folks in Washington are terrified about repeating the mistakes of 93 and begin almost every sentence saying, we learned our lesson back then. But if the lesson is to have bipartisan cooperation and to delegate a lot of credit out to folks across the aisle, can you really get the radical reform that's necessary to deal with the scale of the problem that's grown since 93?
Well, I don't want to imply it's easy, and I certainly don't want to imply it's going to happen in 5 minutes. But I do think, in fact, the only way you're going to get the serious changes we need is if we do it on a bipartisan basis. You've got to have wide support for these kinds of changes in order to accomplish them. And I think what you've got here is a man who is dedicated to achieving that. Now, that doesn't mean every single Republican is going to sign on, or for that matter, every single Democrat will sign on. But it does mean that it's entirely possible, and that's what a lot of us who do this for a living know, it's entirely possible to fashion a set of policies that will work, that will attract broad support, and that's the task before us.
Len, before we go, how do you think the condition of the economy is going to affect any of these hopes for the future of health care?
Well, you know, on the one hand, it is worrisome, obviously, to have our economy in such dire straits that it's in. On the other hand, it is clearly true. Once we realized as a nation we face such an existential threat to our economy, in a way, the health policy conversation in Washington, along with other conversations, got more serious. People realize we have to think about what really matters. And when you think about what really matters, our health care system and the health of our people and being able to afford a health care system that works for everyone is a very, very high priority. And the president-elect has been clear on that and unshaking in that. Senator Baucus and other leaders in Congress have been very clear on that.
Mm-hmm.
And Senator Daschle today would articulate that, I'm quite sure.
Well, well said. Thank you so much, Len Nichols.
Glad to be here.
Len Nichols is the director of the Health Policy Program at the New America Foundation. He joined us from Arlington, Virginia. And Femi Okeh joins us here in the studio with headlines.
Hello there. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. New claims for unemployment benefits drop unexpectedly while continuing claims rise. Now, in the last week, there have been announcements of layoffs from aluminium producer Alcoa and data storage company EMC, among others. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that lender Citigroup is in talks with senators on a law that would bring mortgage relief to millions of homeowners. They want to allow judges to adjust repayment terms for mortgages, and they're calling on other banks to join them. Lebanese militants fired several rockets into northern Israel. Now, no group has claimed responsibility for the attack. Lebanon's prime minister condemned the attacks and also criticized Israel's retaliatory fire. Here's Israeli army spokeswoman Major Leibovich.
A few rockets were launched at Israeli towns in the northern part of Israel. We retaliated to the fire. This is an isolated event, and by no means it has any relevance to opening a second front.
Afghan officials say a suicide bomber attacked a NATO patrol in the south of the country. Three civilians were killed and nine others wounded. The Taliban regularly uses suicide attacks against troops, but the majority of victims have been civilians. The chair of a large Indian outsourcing firm announced yesterday he'd been inflating the books for years. Shares in the company Satyam dropped nearly 80% on India's stock exchange. Has a look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And for nearly a decade, it was a multi-billion dollar no-brainer. The nation with the greatest amount of surplus capital in the world, China, would park its money in the nation with the most secure financial markets in the world, the United States. And over the last 5 years, a seventh of China's entire industrial output has gone into buying American debt. It has financed the spectacular deficits that the United States already has, and it's anticipated will have over the next 5 years. But that no-brainer may be changing, and it has billion-dollar implications for the U.S. government. Joining us now to talk about China's willingness or perhaps hesitation, signs of early hesitation on the part of China to buy more U.S. debt is Keith Bradshaw from The New York Times. He joins us from Hong Kong. Keith, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is perhaps the most important story of the day, if it turns out to be true. I mean, in many ways, we're reading tea leaves, but you say the incentive structure for China buying U.S. debt is suddenly shifting, and we're already seeing signs of it. What are the signs?
What we're seeing is that money in China is now going places other than buying more and more foreign bonds. Where is it going? One, more money is simply leaving the country because investors are no longer so sure that the Chinese economy is the best place to be building factories or the best place to be buying real estate. The Chinese economy is seeing its growth rate slow down in a hurry as a result of the global economic crisis. Chinese exports have plunged. They're very reliant on things like cashmere sweaters or stereos and computers that are the first that people stop buying during a recession like this. So people are taking money out of China. Money is pouring into Hong Kong here. In fact, last month, the Hong Kong government had to issue far more currency than it ever had before because so many people are trying to change Chinese currency into Hong Kong currency. So the money is coming out of China, and it's not coming out the way it had been into U.S. Debt, into the purchase of treasury bonds. Second of all, you've got a slowdown in foreign direct investment, that is big multinationals, not just hot money going in from individuals, but big multinationals aren't putting money into China for long-term projects the way they were. So this foreign direct investment is slowed by a third.
So,
and then finally, the trade surplus is reduced. So the Chinese don't have as many dollars coming in. At the same time, the Chinese also have their own government stimulus plan. They're planning to spend $600 billion over the next 2 years, and they need to raise that money from somewhere. Mostly, the Chinese government is turning to its own banks and saying, please lend a lot more money to local governments so they can build new highways and other projects. The banks had been previously buying bonds from China's central government, and then China's central government would turn around and to use the money to buy foreign bonds.
Right.
Now that cycle has been broken.
All right, let's very quickly talk about the signs that maybe things will change for the United States. Is there a treasury bill auction that may indicate China's willingness or unwillingness to buy more debt? And is there an interest rate issue that we should all be watching?
It's very hard to see the long-term, the short-term effects of this, because right now you've got the Federal Reserve going in already buying very large quantities of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac debt and talking about buying treasuries. But over the next few months, you're really going to start to see the effects of this. The Chinese have been buying foreign bonds almost equal to the entire U.S. budget deficit.
Wow.
Now it's looking like they will be buying as little as, say, equal to one-eighth of the 2009
budget
deficit.
That is a huge takeaway. Keith Bradshaw, thanks for joining us, and it's a gigantic challenge for Barack Obama as he takes office. Thanks for joining us, Keith Bradshaw, in Hong Kong, China, for The New York Times.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning on this Thursday, January 8th. Femi Oke is here with some headlines.
Hello there. The time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. President-elect Barack Obama will soon make his strongest case yet for his economic plan. He's making a major speech in just over 2 hours. His team is working with Congress on a stimulus package that could cost up to $800 billion. It will include tax cuts, new programs, and aid to states. The president-elect's health secretary pick will be the first cabinet member to face Senate confirmation hearings today. Tom Daschle is expected to have a relatively easy time. The former Senate majority leader has lots of friends there. Now, if confirmed, he's set to be the point man in implementing healthcare changes. Firefighters in Boulder, Colorado, are battling to control wildfires that have scorched nearly 3 square miles and forced evacuations of hundreds of homes. It appears that fallen power lines sparked the blaze. A top Pakistani leader is out of a job after a controversy involving the Mumbai attacks. The government fired the National Security Advisor after he told the media that the surviving gunman is Pakistani. The government says the advisor was fired for talking to the press without permission. Fearless passengers on a flight from Atlanta to Los Angeles subdued a passenger when he yelled out bomb threats and ran towards the exit just before the plane touched down. And as the passenger jumped up and ran around the plane, Laura Emilia, who's a spokesperson for the FBI, describes the scene.
He actually assaulted the flight attendant. Multiple passengers then became involved, and at that point, the passenger stated that he had a bomb.
The passengers and flight attendants subdued the man. The FBI were there to arrest him when the flight got into Los Angeles, but they won't be charging him. They suggest that he needs some psychological evaluation. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thank you very much, Femi. Healthcare is on the agenda in Washington, D.C. today as Tom Daschle makes his way through the nominating process towards becoming head of Health and Human Services in the Obama administration. And we're asking you, what should his priority be?
Hi, my name is Mitchell Slutsky. I'm a clinical psychologist, and my recommendations for health care reform would be both to have a universal health care single-payer system and to ensure mental health parity coverage.
And John emailed us saying the first step towards fixing our system of mangled care should be to require all prices to be posted. As people and insurance companies see the difference in rates each is paying, there will be a move toward lower prices. We want to hear your stories at 8778-MYTAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Daschle will be on the Hill answering questions about his thoughts on health care, and he's a passionate advocate of health care reform. This year, he wrote a book called Critical, What We Can Do About the Healthcare Crisis. And last month, he held a healthcare community discussion at a fire station in Dublin, Indiana. Jill King and Travis Ulrich were both there. Jill and Travis, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Jill King, you're a homemaker and you're also a cancer survivor, and you've had some good experience with healthcare and some bad ones. Do you want to tell us about what your experience has been with insurance?
Sure. I have always had excellent insurance. My cancer battle started in 1987, and without the best of health care and the best insurance, I'm sure that I would not be alive today. I had cancer in 1987. It recurred again in 1988 when I was pregnant with my daughter. I had radiation. I've had major surgery. 2 years ago, when my husband's job ended, we were entitled to 18 months of COBRA insurance. When that COBRA insurance was approaching its end, we sought to change our group policy to a private policy, and we were assured by the company that there would be no problem. But a few days before that policy was to end, we were notified that my family was accepted by the policy or by the insurance company, but I would not be accepted, even though I had had that insurance for some time. They informed me that they were not legally obligated to keep me on their policy because I was changing my policy from a group policy to a private policy.
And so that meant for your family, for you alone, you had to pay $8,000 for your health insurance, right? And your family was paying another $5,000 or $6,000 for theirs.
That's correct. That's what we pay now. I had to seek out the only option that was available to me, a program that's available through the state of Indiana that is specifically for people who can't get insurance anywhere else.
And Travis Ulrich, you see things from the other end of it, which is you're an emergency medical technician, and I understand that you actually find yourself in the position when you're called, someone is in need of medical help, but they refuse to get into your ambulance because they do not have health insurance?
Well, something like that. We hear that a lot. We'll want to take somebody in. We tell them they need to get checked out by a doctor, and they'll say, well, I can't afford it. I can't afford the ambulance bill. I can't afford the hospital bill. I don't want to go. I mean, usually these are people, somebody else is calling 911, and they're past the point where it's just a doctor's appointment. They actually need to be checked out pretty much right away.
And so what usually happens in those instances?
Usually what happens in those instances is we try to convince them to go. And at times we've told people that we'll just let them ride for free because we don't want to charge them because, I mean, we very much want everybody to get care. I mean, we don't want to deny anybody just because they don't have insurance. I mean, we don't roll up and ask people if they have insurance. We just kind of see what's going on, and we take them in.
And so, Travis, describe what this meeting was like with Senator Tom Daschle.
It was a very good meeting. He wanted our perspectives. He wanted people's ideas. He just wanted to know pretty much anything healthcare related, and he was very attentive. He would ask questions after everybody talked. He wanted to know more. He wanted to keep asking. He was very passionate, like you said, about the issue.
And Jill, what advice did you give to this former senator?
I think healthcare and health insurance needs to be available to everyone, and we need to figure out how to make it equitable, how everyone has access to preventive care and ambulatory care, and not just hospital care. Some people only have that. We need to make all health care available to all people.
What would make the most difference in your life, Jill?
The most difference in my life.
If there was one change to be made in the health care that's available to you in Indiana, what would that be?
I think it would be that I would have options, that I would have choices, and not be relegated to the final option where they can basically charge me as much as they want to, because that's the only choice that I have. Everyone needs to have choices and options.
And Travis, what was your advice as you were talking to Tom Daschle? What did you tell him?
Basically, again, the same, that everybody needs access to insurance. People have so much to worry about with medical problems as is. They don't need to worry about insurance problems and paying for medical bills on top of all that. And there needs to be more of a focus on preventative care and those type of things.
And I think you were struck particularly by something that Daschle said about your town compared to the rest of the country. What was that?
Right. I mean, just in our little town, there's so many stories like Jill's and others that we've seen. And he reiterated the fact that, hey, this is happening across the country times 300 million people. And, I mean, that just kind of blows your mind to think about that.
And so, Jill, when you left that meeting, what was your thought about him as the potential next head of the Health and Human Services Agency?
I was very positive and very hopeful. He seemed like a very caring man. He listened, and I believe he can make a difference.
Travis, you got the final thought here?
Yeah, I believe very much that he's passionate about this. I believe very much that he's got a huge responsibility, and I think he's the guy for the job, and I think he's going to need a lot of public support.
Jill King, a homemaker and cancer survivor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Travis Ulrich, an emergency medical technician, both coming to us from Dublin, Indiana. Thank you, Travis.
Thank you.
So two people in the middle of the healthcare issue, which, as they said, involves 300 million Americans. Healthcare is the issue with Tom Daschle preparing to head Health and Human Services. And we're looking for stories from your life. What have you seen? What's job one? What needs first aid in America's healthcare?
I heard somewhere that medical schools only take in a certain number of students to become doctors, that there is a limit on this. Is this true? If we had more doctors, we would also have better health care.
The number one issue in health care is to develop a national health care plan and initiative. Barack Obama campaigned on it. He won a strong mandate, I believe, to do something about it. I think we need a single-payer plan. If we don't get that soon, the healthcare system will sink further into a disaster.
It was a national debate in 93, and here we go again as Obama takes office. Tell us your story about healthcare at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Perfecting healthcare won't be an easy task, as your takeaway suggests.
You're not going to write the perfect bill in an administration alcove and deliver it like a sculpture unveiling before the public square.
Learning lessons from 1993 this time around, that's Len Nichols from the New America Foundation talking about the healthcare debate as Obama prepares to take office. We're always on, and if you missed anything like Len Nichols' interesting discussion about the priorities in healthcare and the lessons learned from 93, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Even when you are the president, the government, it turns out, is sometimes the enemy.
If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can hire the A-Team.
The government has the capacity to deliver services more efficiently and effectively. I have seen it done.
Nancy Killefer could be Obama's A-Team for fighting inefficiency in government. Chief Performance Officer. It's an innovation and a classic rerun.
Got that right, crazy man.
So crazy. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, January 8th, and so lovely to wake up with Mr. T this morning. Brings back good memories.
Pity the fool.
Good morning, everyone. Today, we're going to take a look at what that means to be a chief performance officer and what the CIA spies think, or at least one thinks, about their possible new leader, Leon Panetta. Those stories are coming up, but first, headlines.
Israel again halted attacks on Gaza for 3 hours to allow humanitarian aid in, but Red Cross spokesman Iyad Nasir says it's too little, too late for many in Gaza City.
What we have found there is something that makes you feel sick. People were left without water, without food, without being helped. People dead. Without anyone to take care of them. People were waiting for help and died waiting for help.
This as rockets from Lebanese militants fell on Israel's north. Israeli forces returned fire, but military spokeswoman Major Avital Leibovich says Israel isn't looking to move beyond the fight in Gaza.
A few rockets were launched at Israeli towns in the northern part of Israel. We retaliated to the fire. This is an isolated event. And by no means it has any relevance to opening a second front.
Condemnation from Lebanon's government for the rocket attacks and Israeli response. Israel and Hezbollah fought a month-long war in 2006.
International moves to broker a ceasefire are moving forward. Top Israelis are in Egypt to discuss a peace proposal. Cairo says Hamas and Palestinian Authority leaders will also visit. Egypt's UN ambassador Maged Abdelaziz wants more help from America.
We would call on the United States to put more pressure on Israel to accept the Egyptian initiative and to save more lives of the Palestinian people.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice says the U.S. backs the Egyptian-French ceasefire plan. President-elect Barack Obama will soon make his most aggressive case yet for his economic plan. He'll give a speech in about 2 hours pitching it. The mix of tax cuts, new programs, and aid to states could cost up to $800 billion. Today, the House and Senate will count electoral votes and declare an official winner. Gee, I wonder who that is. That would be Barack Obama. He officially becomes President-elect Barack Obama today.
John McCain can't pull this one out even today. Wall Street opens in a half an hour. Dow futures point much lower at this point. Both lost around 3% yesterday, the Dow and S&P. And the S&P begins trading at 9:06. So join the A-team. Healthcare is the issue. Tom Daschle is preparing to head HHS. What's the job one in healthcare if you were taking over tomorrow? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Got that right, crazy man.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We are absolutely serious. We want to empanel and empower you as an A-team to figure out what goes on the government's to-do list to change the way it does business. We're serious. Join the A-team.
Got that right, crazy man.
877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. It seems it's a perennial call for government to operate differently when there's a new administration and a change in leadership in America. We've got to eliminate waste. We've got to do things differently. No more business and as usual. And Barack Obama, speaking yesterday, wanted us to believe that he's more passionate about this than ever.
We committed to changing the way our government in Washington does business so that we're no longer squandering billions of tax dollars on programs that have outlived their usefulness or exist solely because of the power of a lobbyist or an interest group. We can no longer afford to sustain the old ways when we know there are new and more efficient ways of getting the job done.
And so the president-elect turned over a major card that reveals his vision on how to do this. And on the face of that card was a woman named Nancy Killefer.
I know from my experience bringing about change in the private and public sectors that government has the capacity to deliver services more efficiently and effectively. I have seen it done.
She is the chief performance officer in the new administration, joining us to actually accomplish a lot of work, since this card being turned over tells us a lot about what might happen in this new administration. Max Steyer joins us. He's the president and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service. He's personally acquainted with Nancy Killefer. Max, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning.
Well, first of all, the character of this person and her resume, could she fill the shoes of this chief performance officer idea? And then I want to talk about the idea itself.
Sure. Look, it's a heck of a job, and it's not going to be done easily. But if you're going to have someone do this job, Nancy's the right person. She brings to the job not only incredible expertise from the private sector, having been an enormously successful consultant at McKinsey, but very important, she understands what the public sector requires after a significant stint as a chief administrative officer at the Department of Treasury. And that marriage of the two, the private and public sector experience, is something that you don't see all that often. You don't see it in which one person has succeeded in both environments. So she is the right person for the job, but it is, again, one heck of a job to do.
But I'm reminded of when the Bush administration came in, you know, the expertise was from business. And since we've all run businesses, Halliburton in the case of Cheney, Bush's own business experience was something he campaigned on. This private sector model didn't do so well in the Bush administration. How will it do better here?
Well, again, this is not the private sector model. This is the marriage of the two sectors' experience. And that's what is so important.
What does that mean specifically?
Well, it means that there are certain principles, and she, you know, in her very short statement made one of them, which is, and McKinsey's famous for this, and that is that at the end of the day, it's all about the people, the quality of people, who you bring in, how you manage them, how you empower them. And that's a message that does translate over from the private sector to the public sector. And frankly, we haven't seen that kind of attitude taken to public sector employees. Typically, they've been treated like costs rather than valuable assets. And I think she is somebody who can understand how important it is to treat talent right in order to get a better job done.
But what are the limitations here? I mean, Barack Obama has already said that he wants to eliminate earmarks, which would transform the budget process, but that's up to Congress. And then there are all sorts of civil service considerations inside the bureaucracy itself. What's going to have to change to grease the wheels for someone like Nancy Killefer to really be effective?
Look, the most important thing that has to change is this has to be made a priority. Everyone, you know, one of the big challenges for our government is that you have a set of political leaders that turn over every 18 months to 2 years. President stays at least 4 years, but the sub-cabinet turns over at that kind of very rapid clip. That short-term tenure does not incentivize them to focus on the long-term health of the organization, combined with the fact that you don't know something's wrong until it goes wrong publicly. It's a lagging indicator. And the most important thing that we saw yesterday is that the president of the United States, the elect, it stood up with Nancy Killefer and said, this is a priority for me. If he continues to have that kind of focus, we will see real change. But it's going to require that attention from the top.
I mean, Max, just to follow up on what John asked, what does that mean, though, exactly? You're talking about billions and billions of dollars worth of budget. You're talking about hundreds of thousands of employees all over the country. How do you even begin to set up a system to measure what performance is across so many different variables?
You're asking a great question. And one of the things that both the president-elect and Nancy had to say yesterday was that this was not going to be done real fast. It was going to take a long time. Most folks, when they talk about organizational change, talk about a seven-year-plus time period. Doesn't mean you don't get improvements during those 7 years, but to see a true transformation. So directly to answer your question, there are some measurements that exist today. We produce a Best Places to Work ranking for the federal government. We have a survey of 220,000 federal employees. You go to the people who know best, and the federal employees tell you what their agencies are doing, what they're doing well, where the problems are. And that's a measurement that you can take across government today. In 2003, in our first ranking, FEMA was the bottom-ranked agency. You could have predicted that.
That's
when
shocking, Max.
Well, no, but it's shocking because we're looking at it from the retrospective. In 2003, that was before Hurricane Katrina
right,
struck.
Right.
My point is that alarm bell was ringing, but nobody was paying attention until something bad happened.
Well, Max, let's talk specifically then about policy implications there. Barack Obama has said repeatedly that he wants transparency and information to tell the story of how the government is doing. What new technological tools are available to make this Killefer process more transparent and not end up like what happened during the Clinton administration, where Al Gore had this backroom redefining government thing that, you know, was wonky at best and invisible at worst.
Right. Well, look, I think, again, you said something important, which is technology is a tool. It can facilitate the kind of change and transparency we need, but it's only one tool in a larger arsenal. And again, I believe the focus, as Nancy said yesterday, has to be on the people. But you see it today. I mean, you can go to the web and you can see all kinds of information about all sorts of different providers of service that is readily accessible, that you can compare against each other. You can do the same thing with government. Again, the Best Places to Work rankings does that. You can rank FEMA against the Department of Treasury or whatever else it may be. And that public eye, that public view, incentivizes managers inside government to pay attention. There's ways that technology is going to allow better communication. I mean, there are 16 federal agencies that deal with food safety issues. Traditionally, they never talk to each other, never collaborate. Well, now there are tools that enable better opportunities for communication. So technology will be important, but at the end of the day, it's going to require prioritization by the president amidst a very, very busy agenda. It's going to require a true focus on talent that I think Nancy Killefer is going to bring, and it's going to take a bunch of time.
Well, I hear your excitement, Max, but I got to say, when Tom Ridge came in and tried to reorganize national security and the Defense Department under Homeland Security, he got eaten alive by the bureaucracy. What is to say that Nancy Killefer, even as skilled as she is, isn't going to be turned into this giant target within the Obama administration that everyone's going to try to work around?
Look, A, only time will tell. B, the example of the Department of Homeland Security is a great one. They took 22 different subcomponents of different agencies and just put them together under the same roof. They looked for an organizational solution when it was a cultural solution that was necessary. The 9/11 Commission said the quality of the people is more important than the quality of the wiring diagram. In Washington, what people do is focus on wiring diagrams. It's something they can see, they can put their arms around, and they think they can change. What's important here is to focus on something beyond that wiring diagram. How is it that people are working together? What's incentivizing them to do the kinds of things that we need to see happen? How are we measuring that? How are we making it transparent? How are we reconnecting government to people so that they understand what the outcomes are and what they're receiving? Those are the kinds of questions that have to be pushed on and prioritized, and then I think you'll see the change we want. One final, you know, so a quick anecdote on my end. Washington, D.C., the urban myth is that it was designed by the architect at L'Enfant. He did a beautiful job. He did an incredible grid, different letters, numbers, and then one night he got drunk, and he started slashing away at the map, and you have all sorts of different bizarre streets and avenues going which way, every which way. That is the nature of the beast. You know, you think that it's supposed to be logical, and in fact it isn't. But it is still possible to navigate in Washington, D.C. and get around, and I think, you know, if President-elect Obama makes this a priority, we will see change.
And Nancy Killefer is the person to navigate this peculiar Washington logic without terrifying the entire bureaucracy that they're all going to get fired?
Well, I think that she is the right person. She can't do it alone. You said the A-team, and I think the emphasis is less on A than team. It has to be a team effort, and I believe that federal workers, they want to do a better job as well. They need to be empowered to do the kinds of things that President-elect Obama wants to see done in. You'll see a lot of energy from the federal workforce if they're invited in.
All right, Max Steyer, President and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service.
You got that right, crazy man.
Thanks for joining us from Washington.
Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. As we've been talking about, Barack Obama has named a new chief performance officer. It's now Nancy Killefer, former McKinsey consultant. It's now her job to make sure government agencies run smoothly and cost effectively. What would you do in that regard? It's time for you to join the A-Team and be the government's efficiency expert.
I have no time for the jibber-jabber.
That's right. Call 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Okay, that's funny, Mr. A. Anyhow, we're going to take a look at the economy from a bit of a different perch. We're going to take a look at it from the seat of a cab because, of course, few know what's happening in a city like taxi drivers. Isn't that right, Peter?
Yes, exactly. We know everything, everything there is to know.
That's Peter Franklin, who not only drives a cab in New York City for a living, but has turned those daily conversations into reports for BBC Radio and other outlets all around the world. They call him the Gabby Cabby, and lately, Peter, you've been talking to folks about the economy, and what are they telling you?
Well, it's a very interesting development because I always like to say I'm sort of in the trenches, and I get a different perspective than if I was sitting in some lofty office high above the Capitol building. I mean, for instance, one of the leading indicators that I could point out to you and your nice listeners is that people now get into the cab and ask, how much is the ride going to be?
Huh.
And that's in a very amazing situation because that's never happened. I mean, everybody knows a yellow cab, which, by the way, I call mine the Yellow Mobile Conveyance Lounge. You know, if I can't elevate what I do, who's going to do it? But, you know, I mean, everybody knows there's a meter in the cab. You get in the cab and, you know, you don't ask the driver how much is it going to be. I also find a high incidence, not only with myself, but with the other cab drivers. I work for a couple of cousins who have a big garage among the other cab drivers. You're having people who are getting out before the ride is finished, because presumably they've now run out of money. In other words, the total fare would have been $15, but they maybe only have $11. And rather than take the chance of stiffing the driver, jumping out and running away, they say, let me out here. I'll walk the rest of the way.
Are fewer people taking cabs in general?
No, not really. Not really. We got an edge on that because, first of all, we have about 13,000 yellow cabs, which is about the same number we had in 1938. And if you add up the 8.5...
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you don't want more cabs if you're in the cab business. And, of course, people say that's somewhat mean-spirited. You bet it is mean-spirited.
Right. Control
that's
demand.
The way we want it.
It's a monopoly,
you
pal.
Better believe it. So, yes, but if you keep in mind we got 8.5 million people in New York City, 35 million people in the greater New York City area, 50 million people of those foreigners coming here, there's no shortage of people taking cabs. I would say it's just the rhythm of it is somewhat different.
Do you hear a lot of conversations in the back seat of the cab, people talking about the economy, the markets, losing their job, health insurance? I mean, what are they talking about?
That's the only reason I drive the cab, so I can eavesdrop, because you see, everybody's under the assumption the cab driver doesn't understand English.
Yeah.
So I can say anything I want. So that's the best part about it. Everybody's consumed about it. I can't think in my entire out of life, I can think of one subject that consumes everybody more than the economy.
Well, you know, that's interesting because the cab driver and the sort of taxi cab confession idea has grown up around the HBO series where people get into the back of cabs and they're talking only about sex and very sort of personal details. In fact, you say, and you've demonstrated this even on the BBC, that, you know, you're getting sophisticated economic and policy analysis about the U.S. government in the backseat of your car.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, not to knock that show on the HBO, but I mean, some part of it really is baloney because that's not what's going on in a taxi cab. Driving a cab on the streets of New York City, number one, is the funniest job on the face of the earth.
Because
so many strange things are happening. And remember, I'm a New York guy. I grew up in the Bronx, lived on the Grand Concourse. So I can, I understand the New York humor, the New York shtick, and I can kind of play with it. But as far as the people talking in the back of the cab, as I say, that's the best part of the eavesdropping because you hear all of the conversations. As a matter of fact, I remember recently when you were in the taxi, I overheard what you were saying.
Oh, yeah, right. Right.
Nice try.
And I'm sure we were arguing about do you ever go over the 59th Street Bridge?
I go anyplace.
Anyplace.
To me, it's a never ending adventure. You know, we have cab drivers who say, I'm not going to go here, I'm not going to go there. Just think about it for a minute. I pick somebody up, I drop somebody off. I pick somebody up, I drop somebody off. It's sort of like a never ending adventure.
People from all over the world. I mean,
that's
obviously,
it.
It's not just New Yorkers, and you certainly found yourself in the company of some interesting people in your cab.
Oh, absolutely. And my favorite story, can I tell it?
Tell your favorite story.
Okay, when you're driving a cab on the streets of New York, you keep the doors locked because you don't want somebody just jumping into the cab. I was on East End Avenue, And before I knew it, somebody popped into the back of the cab, and the first thing I heard was, "This is a very clean taxi." So I'm thinking, what did I pick up, Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Well, it's a very Tony Upper East Side neighborhood.
No, exactly, right, right. Exactly. And I turn around, and who does it turn out to be but Henry Kissinger? Well, you know, you see these guys in movie and television, what have you, but when the guy is like 6 inches away from your face, it's like it just blows your mind. So I said to myself, I got to do something so this man will remember me for the rest of his life. So as we're driving across Manhattan, I say, you know, you look very familiar to me. He says, yes. I said, did you used to play ball for the Boston Red Sox? Go on a little bit more. I said, weren't you the doctor on General Hospital? You know, so I mean, all the way across Manhattan, I'm asking the most stupid questions in the world. And by the time Kissinger gets out of the cab, he must have thought, who's this fruitcase? So, Henry, if you're listening now, I know who you were.
Did you ever tell him?
No, that would have ruined.
Did he say yes to playing for the Red Sox?
No. He was thoroughly confused because I guess it was a line. You know, here's a man who spent his entire life answering questions to the press, and all of a sudden he's getting this set of questions.
Cabby, thank you for joining us, and thank you for your favorite story. You can hear Peter Franklin on the BBC 5 Live program Up All Night. There's a link to that program on our website at thetakeaway.org. And now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got some headlines.
Good morning. The time is 27 minutes past the hour. The three-hour pause in fighting in Gaza just came to an end. The Red Cross say that Israel failed to fully implement it. And the United Nations says that Israeli forces fired on one of its trucks bringing aid in. The driver was killed. The Israeli army says that they will look into that incident. Sri Lankan troops say that they've captured another Tamil Tiger stronghold. It's on a narrow corridor linking the Jaffna Peninsula to the mainland. The military says that boxes in the rebel group even further, and they make a stand in their jungle bases towards the south. Russia and Ukraine state gas companies had a surprise meeting in Moscow about their energy dispute. This comes ahead of a planned meeting in Brussels with European leaders. And this was their first meeting since Russia stopped gas shipments to Ukraine in a billing dispute. And the cutoff has left many European countries with vastly reduced natural gas supplies. Back in the US, Vice President Dick Cheney and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi preside over a centuries-old task today. They'll count the electoral college votes from November's election. And President-elect Obama wants to hold on to his BlackBerry, and he hasn't finished arguing about it yet, as he told the Today Show in D.C.
This is a concern, I should add, not just of Secret Service, but also lawyers. This town's full of lawyers, if I don't know if you've noticed. So I'm still in a scuffle around that.
And I think he might lose that scuffle. President-elect Obama talking about his BlackBerry.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Live from New York, it's The Takeaway. And the markets are open and down this morning, a little under 1%. And as Femi Okeh said, Barack Obama wants to hold on to his BlackBerry, and he can get a little prickly if you ask him about who's in charge of spying for the United States.
I haven't made a formal announcement about my intelligence team. That may be him calling now.
Well, reporters may be laughing, but agents of the CIA aren't laughing about the appointment of Leon Panetta to be the head of the CIA. He's a former Clinton chief of staff, but he's not someone with direct CIA experience. And to find out what the CIA agents and officers might think about the appointment, we're joined by an expert on the CIA, former operations officer Sam Faddis, the author of the book Operation Hotel California, The Clandestine War Inside Iraq. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
What do officers think of this appointment? It's not unprecedented to have an outsider, a sort of manager type, run the agency. John McCone comes to mind. But what are officers saying to you?
I think across the board, most of the reaction has been pretty negative. And that's not a reflection on Mr. Panetta as an individual. Or he's clearly an intelligent individual and someone with a lot of experience in government. But I think the general feeling is that the changes that need to be made are going to require somebody with a deep background, not only in intelligence, but in human intelligence.
Now, since the Church Committee hearings, which came out of the Vietnam era, which transformed the way the CIA did business, you know, the CIA had a sort of stable period up until post 9/11, and we've seen different reorganizations and different chiefs and a lot of tension within the CIA and the rest of the intelligence community. Do officers believe that the appointment of Leon Panetta is like, here we go again?
I think there's a tremendous amount of feeling that it's exactly that, and really bypassing the core issue, which remains unaddressed. I mean, the core issue is that the CIA continues to not do a very good job of collecting human intelligence overseas, which is obviously the entire reason for its existence. And to really fix those problems, to get down at the street level and address the nuts and bolts of that problem, you're going to have to understand the business. Somebody from outside is not going to be able to do that.
All right, we'll talk about the nuts and bolts then for a second. How do you go about cultivating better human intelligence, recruiting, you know, their language issues, all kinds of issues?
Yeah, language issues are clearly part of it, and there, of course, people talk about the necessity to diversify both in terms of ethnic background and in terms of covers overseas, and all of that is part of it. I think really to bring it down to the most basic issue, what you have is an organization which began once upon a time as a very aggressive, very creative place with a very eclectic mix of individuals who really sort of did whatever it took to get the job done. And it has calcified to a large extent over the course of decades. You hear a lot about people's general conception that the CIA is out you know, going rogue is the standard expression, sort of pushing the envelope, doing these amazing things. And you know, the reality is that really it has become extremely risk-averse, very stiff. It's in danger of becoming just another federal bureaucracy.
Well, Sam, doesn't that argue then for a strong interagency advocate who has the president's ear, and Leon Panetta appears to be that, someone to fight the battles that the CIA continually lost during the Rumsfeld era as Donald Rumsfeld grabbed more and more of the resources for intelligence and put them under the Pentagon?
Well, that's certainly the way to look at this in a positive light, and I have heard that as well. That people hope that what this turns out to be is that Mr. Panetta comes in and he does exactly what you have described, and then he brings with him someone who is then charged with the task of addressing the nuts and bolts and the street level reform. But that remains to be seen. That sort of then begs the question of who else it is that he's going to bring with him.
You know, I'm sympathetic with the whole you need to know the culture of the CIA to operate in it. But in doing a lot of research about Panetta, you know, he runs this foundation out in Monterey that's all about bringing young people into public service. It seems to me he comes with an ethic of new blood, young people, of addressing this calcification that you're talking about. I don't know if he's capable of doing it, but it seems on the surface he's got some of those values.
Well, and we will hope that that's the way that plays out. But just to address one factor that's involved here, what I'm saying is not that what we need to do is allow the CIA to sort of leave it alone, leave it in the hands of the people who are currently in charge, and just let it continue to do business the way it is. I'm saying exactly the opposite. So you're right. You need somebody needs to come in and shake things up fundamentally. Somebody needs to break it out of this system that it's fallen into. You are now faced with the Central Intelligence Agency with the task of penetrating terrorist organizations, drug cartels, organizations smuggling radiological material. This is a fundamentally different task from the Cold War era chasing other diplomats around the cocktail circuit in Western Europe kind of task. And it's going to take a very different mindset and probably take a tolerance for a much higher level of risk.
And Charlie Wilson's war is very much over at this point. Well, a tall order for Leon Panetta. Sam Faddis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Sam Faddis, a retired CIA operations officer, is author of the book Operation Hotel California, The Clandestine War Inside Iraq. He spoke from Washington. And now Femi Okeh has some headlines.
And the time is just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Door, the markets have just opened. What are you seeing?
Basically, they're flat, all three of them, the Dow, the NASDAQ, and S&P.
Okay, thank you very much for that. President-elect Barack Obama speaks in just over an hour, making the case for his stimulus plan. He'll say that big moves are needed fast or else the recession could last for years. His team is working with Congress on a package that could cost up to $800 billion, and it will include tax cuts, new programs, and aid to states. Large parts of Washington state are underwater this morning. Drivers were having trouble getting to work. So that's the sound of cars being flooded on the roadway in North Bend, Washington. But across the state, emergency officials want more than 30,000 people to evacuate. Heavy rain and melting snow has rivers overflowing. A major interstate highway could be closed for days. Russian and Ukrainian energy leaders are in Brussels today, trying to make a deal that will get natural gas flowing again in Europe. And much of the continent's gas comes from Russia through Ukraine, and Europe's supply stopped on Wednesday. Russia and Ukraine blame each other for the crisis. The U.S. Navy is joining the fight against pirates in a big way. An American admiral will command a new international battle group going after piracy off the coast of Somalia. And the mission launches later this month, and some 20 countries will be part of it. Investors have a lot to consider this morning. Retailers provided their December sales figures today, and they confirmed that the holiday season was the weakest in four decades. But one bit of positive news, the number of people applying for unemployment benefits fell last week by 24,000, and analysts expected those figures to be much worse. That's a look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Israeli forces have again taken up bombardments of Gaza today following a three-hour pause in the fighting. But the United Nations says Israeli forces fired on one of its trucks bringing aid in during the pause. The driver was killed. The Israeli army says it's investigating. A few hours ago during today's ceasefire, we spoke with Gaza resident Mohammed Abu Shaban and asked him if 3 hours was actually enough time to complete a day's worth of work getting necessities.
Unfortunately, it is not enough. Like, I went to the bakery at the moment. I found so many people over the doors. And, of course, there will be no time. We only have 1 hour and 20 minutes. And, of course, before about 5 minutes, I've heard an explosion somehow far away from here. But even it means that even in the ceasefire period, they are not ceasing fire, really. Some people are being attacked. Yesterday in the ceasefire, 3 people have been killed. But 3 hours is so much not enough. And even the people you are talking about, more than 1.5 million people who are in need for so vegetables and fruits, if the people are going to buy, are coming from the southern areas, and the southern has been cut completely from Gaza. So even they cannot bring all this stuff that people are in need for.
So, Mohammed, explain how you come up with a strategy each day. Does one person go get the bread, another person stands in line for groceries, another person stands in line for fuel? How do you make your decisions about which to go, which line to stand in?
Yeah, I got it. Unfortunately, it's only me who went today to bring some candles because we are out of electricity since 4 and 7 days. Of course, yesterday we left our home just for less than 1 hour looking for mineral water to bring home. We did not find except 6 bottles. in the supermarket, and barely we found it. Previously, for 10 days completely, nobody got the ability to leave his house to any place because it's so much risky and dangerous outside, and nobody can handle it. Like, we have a small generator of electricity in our house, but we don't have fuel. Nobody is selling at the moment. The petrol stations are off. Barely you can see a supermarket or a pharmacy is opened. But to the moment, it's much risky, and we cannot handle it more.
Mohammed, is the water on or off in your building?
It's off since more than 10 days.
And so the sewage and all of that must be a disaster in your building.
Thanks for addressing the sewage we are handling. We have an outside bumps that are pushing somehow to the outside. But even when you go, when anybody goes to the streets, you see nobody except the garbage and rubbish. The garbage men are not working, of course, in order to collect them from the streets.
Mohammed Abu Shaban, Gaza resident, thanks so much and good luck to you.
Thank you indeed.
Mohammed Abu Shaban, Gaza resident, taking time out during the brief three-hour ceasefire in Gaza to tell us how he gets his necessities, how he and his family resupply in the midst of the siege of Gaza.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, January 8th, and Femi Oke is going to get us caught up with all the latest headlines.
I'd be delighted to do so. The time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. A big economic indicator came out this morning. The Labour Department says that the number of people applying for unemployment benefits fell last week by 24,000. That's the opposite of what analysts expected. They were predicting a big jump. Senate confirmation hearings for President-elect Barack Obama's cabinet begin today. Former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle is the first. He's been picked to head the Department of Health and Human Services. Fighting in Gaza continues. Israel was attacked from the north today. Lebanese militants fired rockets into northern Israel, injuring two people. The International Red Cross is speaking out about the conditions they are seeing in the Gaza Strip. South of Gaza City, they found 15 bodies with several hungry and emaciated children. The Red Cross says that if the Israeli army doesn't want to help civilians, they should allow the Red Cross access to do so. The Pakistan government has fired its national security adviser. They say he was giving unauthorized interviews. He told the press that the surviving gunman in the Mumbai attacks is a Pakistani citizen. And firefighters continue to battle a stubborn wildfire near Denver. The blaze caused more than 900 homes to be evacuated, and a down power line may well be to blame. That's a look at stories making the headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So, as we've been talking about all morning, Washington, D.C. is crackling with drama and developments. We've got an inauguration coming up. There's the Obama transition. There's Roland Burris. Who can resist that? And then there's a leadership battle going on for the GOP, the poor, embattled GOP. And one of the great people to give us a look at what's going on down there in Washington is Anna Marie Cox, a contributor to The Daily Beast and a founding editor of Wonkette. Anna, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So, you know, there's so much to talk to you about, but it's fair to say that the zeitgeist is in such turmoil right now with an inauguration coming up that could attract 5 million people to Washington. Of course, the transition is mid-play right now. The cards are being turned over and the Obama vision is becoming clear. And then you've got all the people who were in power for the last 8 years licking their wounds and trying to figure out what's going to happen next. I mean, you're just a pig in it, right, Anna?
It is kind of a fun time to be in Washington, although I have to say, as a Washington Reddit resident, I'm dreading inauguration just a little bit.
Right, but you've rented your apartment for $10 million a week, right?
I think the real way to make money, I tried to reserve a car for that day, is actually I'm just going to drive around and be a gypsy cab. That's, nice. That's the way to make money in Washington. Nice. Inaugurate.
Well, let's begin with certainly my personal obsession, and I happen to know it's yours as well, the Roland Burris, Senate Blagojevich issue. First of all, I want you to get whatever it is you want to say about that off your chest so we can move on to the GOP leadership.
Well, I'm just super excited to have Roland Burris be a senator. There aren't enough crazy people in the Senate currently.
Now, why do you think Roland Burris is crazy?
Well, I don't know if I am not a licensed medical professional, so I can't say for sure. But he does speak in the third person and use the royal we. And he believes that God wants him to be a senator. So I know that's not crazy, but he is a great exaggeration of the self-regard that most senators have of themselves. Like, he's like, you know, he's he is the senator that stands for every other senator in a way. And I think that's why they initially didn't like him.
Hmm. And does that argue for him getting seated or not? What's your
Will be seated. I mean, and I think that once he's seated, once you're a member of that club, you're in.
That's an interesting reason, given that we have a president who thinks that God wanted him to be president.
Well, I think he's a little crazy, too. So, I'm equal opportunity on that front. But I do think Roland Burris will be seated in part just because they want this sideshow to be over. And I think once he's seated, I'm told that negotiations are they'll seat him if he will agree not to run in 2010. I don't – from what he's said so far, I don't think – even if he says he won't run in 2010, I don't see him necessarily sticking to that promise. But the man has never won a primary race in his life. So I don't think we have to worry.
He has statewide troubles back in Illinois. All right, let's talk about the chairman of the Republican National Committee. There are six candidates. The race card is all over this. What is the RNC trying to achieve? And how bitter is the conflict between these various candidates?
Well, what they're trying to achieve, I wish they knew. I think there is a consensus that they need to change something. That is what all six candidates seem to agree on. They agree on a lot, actually. There's not a lot of competition between the candidates. But younger activists feel very strongly that the GOP needs to sort of rebrand itself. And there's a lot of emphasis and talk about not just using technology, but really trying to sort of incorporate technology and ways of using it into the party, much as Obama was able to with his campaign.
Well, does Ken Blackwell, former Ohio Secretary of State, fit that mission?
Hey, he has 4,000 Facebook friends, man. So who knows? Maybe that means something. There was a moment in the RNC chair debate the other day where they compared how many Facebook friends they had. And I have to say that's not a good sign, necessarily.
Probably not.
If that's what they consider to be technologically, engaged.
All right, Chip Saltzman, who came to prominence as the campaign manager for Governor Mike Huckabee, what argument does he have?
Well, he doesn't have much of a chance right now. He's the youngest of them. I believe he's 40, and he's a Southerner, and he definitely sort of comes out of while he's been a party activist for a long time, the Huckabee candidacy was definitely outside the RNC.
Right.
He is something of an outsider, and he had kind of a long shot chance until it came out that he sent out a Christmas goodie bag to RNC members. And it contained one of the things was a CD of songs, and one of the songs was Barack the Magic Negro.
Not a fabulous moment there for the
No, not
the
a fabulous
RNC.
Moment. But what's interesting is that I think in other years you might have heard people kind of gather around him and, accuse people that accuse his critics as being politically correct. That's not happening right now. I think it's a sign of growth of the RNC, or at least things have changed when that becomes unacceptable.
Yeah, well, change we need in this particular case.
Yes.
All right, so Mike Duncan is running for re-election. Is he a shoo-in here, or is there a serious challenge?
Well, again, in any other time, he would be a shoo-in because the RNC chairmanship is very unlike the DNC, the Democratic National Committee chairmanship, which is really a member. It activists can play a part in that. The RNC chairmanship, they are elected by the 168 members of the Republican National Committee. And traditionally, the way you get elected is you call up these 168 people and you say, hey, remember how I got you a seat in the convention floor? Mm-hmm. And you wanted to meet the candidate, and I arranged for you to have coffee with him, or, and that is how you would get elected.
So
and,
it's
and
hard. So it's really hard to do a vision candidacy there. I mean, in other words, if the party decides that representing the South and projecting a Southern strength, you know, and that would argue for Katten Dawson, the South Carolina Republican Party chairman, it's hard to make that happen. But if the party also thinks that maybe Michigan is a great idea, that would argue, you know, make it difficult for Saul Anousis, who's a Michigan Republican Party chair. What do you think the party consensus is? Do we go South? Do we go Midwest?
Wow. You know, I wish I could say. I talked to as many members of the committee as I could, but I don't know all 168. I think that Duncan would have had a shot in any other year, and he had a shot until they had their public debate. When it became clear that he does not have personally a vision to rebuild the party, I think that they might take their chance on someone new.
All right. Well, there may or may not be a Wonkette Gypsy cab on Inauguration Day in Washington, but if there is, Anna Marie Cox will be driving it. She's a contributor for the Daily Beast blog, founding editor of Wonkette. Anna Marie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
There are 19 members of President-elect Obama's cabinet headed for Senate confirmation, so a lot more happening besides Roland Burris. Over the next 2 weeks, we'll be following these personalities and concerns about them on the program and also online at thetakeaway.org. Today, health care is an issue because Tom Daschle is the first one up. He's preparing to head the Health and Human Services. But first, he's going to be answering a few questions on Capitol Hill today. We're asking you, what needs first aid in America's health care?
I think it's important that the changes in mental health care needs to be addressed. I applied for disability benefits, short-term disability, through my group insurance where I worked. They denied me short-term disabilities because, filling out the application, I said that, yes, I sought occasional therapy and on a low dose of antidepressant. They denied it. I appealed twice. They still denied it. And never mind that I work in a highly stressed environment. I have a good attendance record. It can happen to anyone. And you mentioned mental health, and you're penalized for it.
Leslie writes us in an email, the new administration should integrate holistic and alternative health care modalities into the existing system. They should reimburse people for choosing practitioners of naturopathy, Chinese medicine, homeopathy, and other complementary therapies.
Hear, hear to that. What do you think? Tell us your take on our website, thetakeaway.org. And here's a takeaway, perhaps, today about the new chief of efficiency.
You don't know something's wrong until it goes wrong publicly.
That's Max Steyer from Partnership for Public Service talking about the new chief performance officer, Nancy Killefer. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.